Some people were hesitant about a coronavirus vaccine even before it was developed, even before scientists knew they could develop one. This was new, but vaccine hesitancy itself is not a new phenomenon. The by now repeatedly debunked paper by Andrew Wakefield, claiming the MMR vaccine might be linked to autism, is often singled out as the epicenter of contemporary vaccine hesitancy. But the public's concern about vaccines date all the way back to the 18th century, when people expressed religious concerns about what vaccination might mean for the afterlife. Vaccine hesitancy is usually treated as a subcategory of a bigger problem these days, the death of expertise. According to this narrative, people have stopped listening to experts, relying instead on Google searches and social media influencers for advice on important topics. Populist politics has brought about not only a resentment for economic and cultural elites, but also knowledge elites, science experts, public health bodies, and university professors. This resentment of expert advice is seen as an existential threat. If people don't believe in climate change and the efficacy of vaccines, humanity itself might be in danger. This war, as it's often framed, between knowledge and ignorance needs to be won. And the way to win it is by educating the public, those who think a scientific paper and a blog post by a lay person have the same claim to truth. Only this approach doesn't seem to be working. Maya Goldenberg believes it's because this is the wrong approach. Phenomena such as vaccine hesitancy don't exist because the public is ignorant and doesn't understand the science. Vaccine hesitancy exists because the public has lost trust in scientists and the public bodies they advise. The way to tackle people's concerns, therefore, isn't by yet another public information campaign, but by listening to those concerns, addressing them, and in the process, regaining the public's trust. Welcome to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. I'm delighted to have as my guest today, Maya Goldenberg. Maya is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Guelph in Canada, and the author of the forthcoming book, Vaccine Hesitancy, Public Trust, Expertise, and the War on Science. Maya has been working on the topic of vaccine hesitancy long before the coronavirus pandemic, but her book couldn't have been better timed. She has thought hard about all the issues around vaccine hesitancy that we read about in the news, and I couldn't think of a better placed philosopher to help us understand this phenomenon. Maya Goldenberg, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
So your life's work has been building up to this moment, hasn't it? A pandemic, a new vaccine developed to protect us from the illness, and along with it, a degree of vaccine hesitancy by the public, and even in some cases by health professionals. What has it been like to watch the news on the subject matter that you know all too well from your research?
A couple of friends have commented that this might be the best timed philosophy book ever, which is nice. I've been working on this project for a number of years. The focus is vaccine hesitancy, and I looked specifically at pediatric vaccine hesitancy in industrialized nations. It was right as I was finishing up sort of last edits and revisions when the COVID pandemic struck. So I had just enough time to pause for a second and think, do I need another chapter? Do I need to rethink things? But it was sort of we couldn't tell at that point. So I added a preface to the reader saying that this is where things were at. I was just finishing as COVID was starting. But I believe that the philosophical themes that I look at, specifically public trust and problems of expertise, will be germane to the COVID landscape as well. And so far it has. As I watch the news, we are seeing in some ways, some things have become more explicit than they were around pediatric vaccines, which I'm happy to to comment on if you'd like to talk about COVID and COVID vaccines.
Yes, the timing is interesting. You say that, it can be both a blessing in some ways, but also a curse. You're worried about whether what you've been saying up until now is going to be tested in some way by events. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about vaccine hesitancy in respect to COVID, how it's been expressed so far. Has it surprised you at all? Is it kind of what you were expecting to see? Tell us a little bit about what it's like.
This was an interesting case study for vaccine hesitancy because there are some unique features of the COVID vaccine. First is that vaccine hesitancy was present and noticeable before we even had the vaccine. So there was anti-vaccine sentiment and anti-vaccine mandate sentiments being expressed. I saw it as early as April 2020. So pretty much as soon as lockdown started.
Before we had a vaccine.
Yeah. Right, right. So it was sort of just as the first of the lockdown protests were happening in Canada and elsewhere, you saw people showing up at those rallies with signs saying no vaccines, no mandates, because they anticipated what was going to happen. So that already is unique. We've always talked about vaccine hesitancy in the context of vaccines that already existed. So there was some profile, some understanding of it, maybe not a very good understanding, but it was there. Also, the question about mandatory vaccines, which has sort of been nagging at it the whole time, is slightly unique because most of our discussions around vaccine requirements focus on children. And because we talk about children and dangers to children, it elicits a certain emotional response that is different from when we talk about adult vaccination. So this is the first time in a long time that we have been talking about the potential vaccine requirements for adults.
Since you mentioned the fact that vaccine hesitancy is not a new thing, perhaps we can go into a little bit around the history of vaccine hesitancy. So we've all heard that it has something to do with a now debunked study around the connection between MMR vaccines and the development of autism. We might have heard of the name Wakefield, the person behind that study. But what are the specifics of that story? And is it the only thing that has played a role in the phenomenon of vaccine hesitancy in the past, pre-COVID times?
Vaccine hesitancy is as old as vaccines itself. There's evidence of anti-vaccine sentiment back in the days of Edward Jenner. So this was a new technology. People were uncomfortable with it. It was exposing a healthy and otherwise healthy body to a dangerous pathogen. So back in the times of Jenner, people thought that you were introducing, because it was a cowpox vaccine, it's supposed to inoculate you against smallpox via the cowpox instead of the smallpox itself, which was more dangerous. People were afraid that it was somehow anti-religious and it was going to turn people into a cow. What we can learn from that, and if you carry on anti-vaccine sentiments and how they've gotten framed throughout history, is that vaccine hesitancy is some sort of expression of the cultural fears and anxieties of the time. So during Jenner's day, it had to do with religion and what the afterlife would be like for you if you exposed your body to something that was considered unclean and unholy. When we get into more contemporary versions of vaccine hesitancy, and they existed prior to Wakefield too, they're usually speaking to something about the current state that we're in. So Wakefield is often credited for creating the current phenomena of vaccine hesitancy, but it existed prior to him. There'd been a pertussis, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus vaccine scare in the 1980s. It was largely in the United States due to a television program that had been aired raising questions about the vaccine, and it caused a lot of concern. So when Wakefield was around, there was already growing sentiment in Britain at the time that there was something not right about this new MMR vaccine. So there'd already been separate vaccines, but the triple vaccine, the MMR, was new to the British schedule. And there were parents who were thinking that children being diagnosed with autism, which was a fairly new the diagnosis was just sort of coming into public consciousness, that it was related to this new MMR vaccine. And they were starting to find each other. This was early days of internet, so they were starting to find each other online.
Early online forums.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And let's just say the concern and the suspicion that it was connected to this new vaccine was already there. What Wakefield did was capitalize on that concern and write this paper, and it just exploded. No one scientific paper in a journal that very few of us can read is going to switch public sentiment in such a way. So what he did was actually carry forward something that was already there. We found out later that he'd actually been paid by a barrister to create evidence for parents that were already planning to sue the government over their children's vaccine-related autism. That was the charge. So it was there already. It wasn't that Wakefield created it. Mm. He was able to coast on that concern and catalyze it by giving it scientific credibility and giving it a lot more attention than it had gotten before.
That's really interesting what you said about how each era kind of sort of streamlines its cultural anxieties and expresses them through things like vaccine hesitancy. I know this is a bit maybe more of a, I don't know, anthropological question or a sociological question rather than a philosophical one, but I'll ask you anyway. What do you think the main cultural anxieties today are that are fueling vaccine hesitancy in relation to the vaccines that have been just developed a few months ago?
For my research for the book, I had to read pretty widely, so I'm pretty well versed in the medical anthropology and sociology. And this is where how you answer the question. I looked at a lot of qualitative research on vaccine hesitant parents. I was limited to English language, and I was focused on industrialized nations. So I can't say I have a full view, but I will say in the many countries and the many studies that I read, parents were very clear about why they were hesitating. They almost always expressed concern about financial conflicts of interest in health research and health practice. So their concern about corporate influence on healthcare, that was expressed again and again. I don't know how that gets missed in media accounts of vaccine hesitant parents. They're always seen as selfish or stupid or something like that. They actually are very clear about what their concerns are. And that said, number one, that is probably the number one cited problem. Sometimes they express things that would count as pseudoscientific, like isn't natural immunity better? And do we really need vaccines? I've heard they don't work. But more than anything, they're expressing those anxieties about the way we do health research. And more generally, if science is being done in the public interest rather than corporate interest. I found a second direct cause that I think is very important here, but is underexpressed, is medical racism and health injustices. I think that is a major driver of vaccine hesitancy. But wouldn't you know, it was actually very difficult to prove that because so much of the empirical research on vaccine hesitant parents
is on white people.
And I tried to get to the bottom of this because it seemed like such a miss. And it's recognized as in the studies as a limit. So they'll write in their limitations of the study, well, 70% of our respondents to our survey self-identified as white. But it was kind of seen as, isn't that too bad? And there was no active effort to correct this. And when I looked at their methods, you can see why that happened. The tendency was to use convenience sampling, where you do things like you go to a clinic, even if it's a clinic in an urban center that's very diverse, and you leave your phone number on a bulletin board. Well, social scientists know who are more likely to answer to those requests. It's people with the time to talk to social scientists and people who feel empowered enough to want to share their opinions. If you want to talk to racialized and otherwise marginalized people, you have to actively recruit them. And that was not done.
That's kind of, surprising, especially in the context of some countries like the US, where we have very good reason to to think that the Black community especially has perhaps good reasons to be suspicious of the medical establishment. There's the well-known case of the Tuskegee kind of scandal. So, you know, there is history there. And so you'd think that they would actually kind of look into that.
Yes, that's been an interesting change in the way the media has talked about the COVID vaccine. It made it to public awareness, like even New York Times was reporting how members of Black and Latinx communities were more vaccine hesitant than white communities. And that was the first time I'd really seen vaccine hesitancy and race being brought together in a clear kind of way. When I had entered the pediatric vaccine hesitancy, I came in with this sort of general understanding that it's just rich white people that hesitate about vaccines. And the only reason I came to question that and start looking into it is I also came in with this understanding that it's got something to do with scientific misunderstanding. As I started to research, I said, no, I think it's got something more to do with trust. And then if it is a problem of trust, why would it be that BIPOC communities would be more trusting of vaccines, knowing that they are less trusting of healthcare altogether? And then when I went to look at it, it was the case that it just had not been studied. I think I found 5 studies looking at Black American versus white American attitudes about vaccines. I found 1 about pediatric vaccines and the rest were about adults on influenza vaccine. And there you actually saw it. You saw far more mistrust, far more vaccine hesitancy among Black Americans. And they talked about Tuskegee all the time. They know about it and they mention it. Yeah.
I want to put a pin on what you just mentioned about the different approach that you take to this question of vaccine hesitancy and look first at what the dominant way of thinking about it has been and what you think the problems are with that kind of approach. So, you know, vaccine hesitancy is not, as it were, in a vacuum. There is a kind of broader conversation around the death of expertise, and you've given a great talk about this narrative. So this narrative goes something like this, and I'm kind of simplifying, but the idea is that people have just stopped following experts, right? Scientific experts in particular. And there's a great deal of alarm around this. You know, this is a danger to society, a danger to democracy. And the diagnosis has come with a diagnosis about the situation of our politics. So along with populist attitudes towards politics and resentment towards elites, we are experiencing populist attitudes towards knowledge and resentment towards elites, but elites of knowledge in this case. And we have the equivocation of the informed opinion of experts with the ignorant opinion of non-experts. What is wrong with this picture in your view?
Okay, well, people are very concerned about this problem of expertise. It gets a lot of attention in science studies and political science as well. And so it's an effort to characterize this problem that experts do not hold the same public regard as they used to. So I'll agree with that. They do not. The white coat was allegedly once more venerated than it was now. And science studies scholars often point to post-World War II moments of scientific optimism and economic boom. So that's the time when like the polio vaccine came out and first astronaut on the moon. So this is a time where people were really awed by science. And because of that, scientists received a lot of admiration for their expertise. So let's agree that it's not really like that anymore. Scientists need to work for it more than they used to. But to call it the death of expertise, and that term comes from Tom Nichols. He's a political scientist, maybe professor of government, who wrote a paper and then a book. And the suggestion there is that no one listens to experts anymore. People go for Yelp reviews or crowd content and think of it that it's somehow got the same stature as expert opinions. But my take on it is that it is not true that no one listens to experts anymore. Instead, what we've got is expertise has proliferated to include non-traditional experts. And that points back to the crisis of trust that I'm advancing. So now people will look to social media influencers, natural health advocates for health advice in a way that they used to go to their doctor or the public health agencies. And that is different, that's for sure. But it is not the case that we've got a leveling expertise here. Instead, people still need expert advice. There's too much out there to know. People spend time online because they are looking for expert advice. They're just challenging who are the legitimate experts anymore. Mm. I think most interesting is noticing these kind of insider-outsider experts. So I'm thinking of traditionally trained experts, like with scientists and doctors, who now hold unconventional views about, say, vaccines or lockdown. So I'm thinking of Andrew Wakefield as a good example of that. In my book, I actually dedicate a full chapter to talking about Andrew Wakefield as the maverick expert. So he is trusted by many because he has all the scientific training and the credentials. So we see there that some of the conventional characteristics of expertise are still respected. We like the MD, we like the PhDs, but what makes him unique is that he stands outside of the in-group, outside of the community of scientists. And the problem is that there is now mistrust of scientific institutions and those in-group belongings. So if you look at sort of sociology of expertise and people advance all these hierarchies of expertise, usually in-group belonging, so belonging to the community of experts, advances your stature as an expert. For sure, you need to have the PhD or the MD, but you also need to be part of that community. Suddenly, because there is a sort of wavering on whether those groups and institutions are trustworthy, the trained expert who stands outside of the group is seen as more trustworthy, as speaking truth to power, as actually trying to nobly enhance science in the public interest, rather than those groups who are apparently corrupted by corporate interests or other power interests.
This podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. The new issue of The Philosopher is out, tackling a topic that philosophers from Parmenides to Heidegger have grappled with, the concept of nothing. In this issue, you will also find essays on alienation, animal ethics, as well as thoughtful reviews of Kate Maine's and Rutger Bregman's latest books. If you'd like to order a copy of the latest issue and subscribe to the journal, go to www.thephilosopher1923.org. There's one more aspect of the received way in which this discussion has taken place, this kind of combative terms in which the discussion is framed, warlike terms almost. So the idea is that there's a war going on between science and ignorance, knowledge, and poorly researched opinion online. And this diagnosis is, you argue, also part of what then is seen as the remedy, which is, okay, the way to win this war is to replace ignorance in the public with knowledge and to unleash kind of information campaigns about scientific findings and to perhaps marginalize or even to some extent shame non-scientific players in this discourse. So you think this framing of the problem in these terms is deeply problematic. Why is that? What do you think is the problem here?
Well, wars require this separation of good and evil. And the assumption is once a war has erupted that it's too late for resolution and that the enemy needs to be vanquished. And if we limited our enemy to disinformants, I might say, okay, let's do this war. But attached to that enemy framework is people who I think are very well-intended, these parents who are struggling to make decisions for their kids. So I start first with a very charitable reading of vaccine-hesitant parents. I think they are struggling with competing influences and information. And when you frame it as a war, you are going to further alienate those parents. We see a lot in the media, shaming of parents. Usually it's mothers, because mothers make most health decisions for families, going to their physicians to ask questions about vaccines, often, you know, new mothers postpartum with a baby in tow, and they feel shut down and silenced by their doctors, who are at this point so frustrated by these anti-vaxxers. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, by not being kind and just being respectful enough to answer these questions, these doctors and the media perpetuate this sort of this epistemic injustice that women in health, women patients in healthcare know all too well, where your questions and your voice is not taken seriously, and you further the kinds of harms and divisions, which is exactly what we shouldn't be doing. We should be compassionate towards people that are concerned about their children and want to do the best thing. And we should be answering their questions kindly and listening to what their concerns are, instead of trying to hand them another leaflet and saying, here's everything you need to know. And if you don't accept everything on this fact-based leaflet, you're somehow stupid or a bad mother. That's where the war on science has gotten us in terms of addressing vaccine hesitancy.
I'll pick on something I heard in your reply there, which is like there is an element of sexism involved in this kind of received narrative. You know, there are lots of disparaging terms like mommy blogger or things like that that are kind of bandied about. Is this something that is more than just kind of below the surface? Is that quite explicit?
I think it's quite explicit. It's a lot of mocking of mothers. So mothers, as the healthcare decision makers in families, they are more likely to be vaccine hesitant, more likely to join, you know, online forums around vaccines. So vaccine hesitancy is of course generally not regarded kindly by people who are, you know, pro-science and pro-vaccines, but there's definitely a gendering of the problem that I think is unfair to mothers who really struggle to make these decisions. Mothers are put under a lot of pressure to make good decisions for their children, and there's no sympathy for that. Women should be treated kindly and not constantly being scrutinized over every decision they make, especially around their children. Let's also recognize that if you put too much pressure to make the right decisions, some people are going to buckle under that pressure and make wrong decisions.
Yeah, that sounds very problematic in numerous ways. Let me play devil's advocate here for a moment with your attempt to read these concerns in a charitable kind of way. So picking up on something that you say in your paper, public misunderstanding of science, reframing the problem of vaccine hesitancy. So in that paper, you engage with surveys done of parents and their attitudes towards vaccines, and you're trying to understand the concerns they raise, not as scientific illiteracy or as an anti-science attitude, but as a concern for their child. And you bring up this interesting distinction, which is quite loaded in philosophy, right? You say something like, there's a tension between what the parents see as this kind of broad brush, generalizing approach of vaccine studies, and the perhaps rare but existing particular cases where something might go wrong and a vaccine might have some kind of negative side effect. And their reasoning is very much, well, I don't care what happens, say, in 99.9% of the cases. I care about what happens to my child in my child's case. I'm kind of paraphrasing here. But what you highlight here is a kind of tension between what in philosophy is called the universal and the particular. And my question is whether this tension is inherent inside in a scientific approach, right? I mean, there have been philosophers in the past. I'm thinking about Theodore Adorno and his critique of Enlightenment thought. This strand is there in Nietzsche to some extent. So these philosophers have complained that, you know, this concern for the universal and the indifference towards the particular is just inherent to the way that the scientific approach, you know, distorts reality in some ways, imposes a uniformity on something that isn't there. So if this is true, aren't the parents who think of science as offering too general an approach and not concerned with, you know, their particular cases, ultimately, even if unbeknownst to them, express a kind of anti-scientific attitude? Sorry, a bit of a long-winded question.
That's okay. It's an interesting question. My answer is these parents are interested in their children's health. They are not taking a stance on science. In fact, the kind of qualitative research that led me to this assessment that they're more interested in individual risk about their own child than something like, you know, risk at the population suggested to me that they understand the science just fine. They're not anti-science, but that's not what they need to know right now. They need to know whether their kid is going to be harmed, and that requires individual risk assessments. So they are recognizing some limits to what the science can tell us, and that's not an anti-science view. I think it is a call on scientists to get to this information. The parents are telling them what they need to know in order to be comfortable to make these decisions. So let's get more into individual risk assessment. There is areas of science that work on this. There's adversomics that looks at adverse events and who could be more prone to them. It's not a well-funded and well-established area of research. If the parents are saying, this is what I want to know, this is what is keeping me from being confident about vaccine choices, put your attention into that. That way, the interests of the parents and the interests of public health and the scientists can align. And that's exactly what science and the public interest should be.
You're listening to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. If you'd like to offer suggestions for future topics and guests, you can email me at newsphilosopher@gmail.com. Sorry we've taken so long to come to the way that you're framing this debate, and your diagnosis of the problem is very different from the terms we've been discussing it so far. So you recognize, you acknowledge that there is a crisis of sorts, but it doesn't have to do with the public and its ignorance or its ideological opposition to science, but the problem lies actually with the scientific community and its institutions. So there is a crisis, but it's not a crisis of knowledge, it's a crisis of trust. And it's not the public that's responsible for it, it's the scientific community that is responsible for it. So why is trust important in understanding this question of vaccine hesitancy? And what do we mean exactly when we talk about trust here?
When we talk about trust, I'm referring to epistemic trust. So this speaks to how the public interacts with scientific information. Most of us do not have the kind of specialized knowledge that you need to really look through the data and all the scientific information about vaccines. It requires not just knowledge of virology and immunology and many other things. I'd say even very few people that are in the sciences have a comprehensive understanding of all things related to vaccines because it's so complex. Instead, we rely on epistemic trust. We rely on the testimony of trustworthy experts to get us to where we need to be in terms of knowledge for everyday decision making. So I'm probably not saying anything that's too surprising to you. There's just too much to know. As I think John Hardwig said, you know, back in the 1980s, there's too much for any one of us to know. Instead, we rely on experts. So epistemic trust is pervasive. It's even in science, as he argued, but it's certainly explicitly the case in public response to scientific information. Again, it's not that the public are not interested or unable to assess any kind of data and logical arguments, but we need the heuristics to demonstrate to us what information is worth accepting and incorporating into our daily lives. So because of that, the fact that people are not lining up for vaccines, despite the strong consensus telling us that we should, means that there is some kind of breakdown in the knowledge translation relationship, where if all goes well, the trustworthy experts tell us what we need to know, and the epistemically dependent public accept that information and incorporate it into their decision making. And that's not happening right now. And that says that there is a breakdown of trust, not a breakdown of scientific information. People are very wedded to that idea that it's a problem of information, that people are scientifically misinformed or disinformed, or just if only they just had the proper information, then everyone would line up for vaccines. But there is a lot of evidence that that is not the problem here. In fact, a lot of very scientifically literate people are vaccine hesitant. All the sociological studies of who is your vaccine hesitator, they find this like polarity. They find a polarity among the most educated members of the public. They are the most vaccine accepting, but they're also the most vaccine hesitant and refusing. So this is a problem of trust here, not a problem of scientific information. And because of that, I tried to explore that a little more. And that did lead me to all kinds of different ways of addressing the problem. One, it made me think that all this fact-driven information campaigns, while not unhelpful, I don't think they are getting at the key problem here. Because if someone doesn't trust the source, if they don't trust the CDC or Public Health England or whoever the expert body is, then it doesn't matter how many studies you're going to cite. They're going to say there's something corrupt about the whole system. I reject them all.
So I think there's definitely something right here, right? I mean, most of us don't know anything about pharmacology or climate science, and yet we come to accept most of the things that, or some of us do, that the scientific community claims about those areas. Okay, here's one way of pushing back against the idea that it's only about trust, right? For sure, there's an element of trust, but then you might ask a question, doesn't scientific literacy play a role in that trust, right? So sure, I know nothing about pharmacology, but I have some vague understanding of the processes that, say, a scientific paper has to go through before it gets published, or some idea of what double-blind studies involve. Again, I'm not an expert on those things, and I, you know, couldn't give you a kind of definitive account of them. But having an idea about what those things involve gives me a sense of reassurance that, you know, science is something that is rigorous, that its results are not arrived at by accident, but through a kind of a process. So doesn't this kind of bring us back to this question of not scientific literacy, like, but kind of like meta-scientific literacy, that, you know, you don't have to understand the specifics for sure. You need to trust the scientists at that. But the reason you trust the scientists isn't because, you know, you like them, or because you know people in your social group that are scientists and you kind of think they're okay, but that you have some idea about what science involves.
Well, knowing what science involves can make you more accepting of science, but it can also, it makes some people less accepting too. If you know the limits of peer review, if you know that, you know, studies are rarely replicated because we don't have the time or energy, if you know about the problem that people often don't publish negative results, or scientists being gagged from publishing negative results if they're in contract with a pharmaceutical company. I mean,
right.
Those who are scientifically literate might know the limits of that of that sort of general methodology. Those concerns are going to be heightened if it's a decision that impacts you directly or your family. That might be when you suddenly start to think maybe science works well most of the time, but this might be the time that it doesn't. And the risk, because it's immediate, can shape your perception of the problem. It's not a perfect system. We all know that. We also know that those of us who are scientifically literate also should know that it's the information is emerging. It's constantly changing. That is probably a move towards truth. But when we're talking about new technologies like this COVID vaccine, there are even very scientifically literate people who are saying, hold on a second, we don't have full access to the data. We don't have long-term data, that kind of thing. I'm interested right now in vaccine hesitancy among healthcare workers, those who are first in line. This is exactly your case study. This is your scientifically literate group, the people who probably think that health research is a good that helps us most of the time, but they are hesitant about this vaccine. And that says something about the sort of gaps that occur. Perhaps the gaps have collected in a way that makes them unsure they want this vaccine. That's an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, you mentioned in arriving at this argument that trust plays a big role in these behaviors of vaccine hesitancy or trust in experts more generally. You talk about the social nature of scientific research, and you say, for example, that goes against the way we usually think about science. There's this Enlightenment legacy of thinking about scientific approaches are fundamentally skeptical, and maybe Descartes has a role to play here. But that, in fact, in today's environment and the scientific projects being as complex as they are, no one scientist can carry out a project by themselves. So scientists need to trust their colleagues and their findings in order to make any progress. So is there a connection? Do you see a connection between this internal trust, as it were, between scientists? So, for example, in the case of the healthcare workers, perhaps that's a case of not quite trusting or not being sure about the processes going on within the scientific community, even though they're a part of it, and the way that we think of trust between the scientific community and those outside of it. What's the connection there?
I guess healthcare workers are a little bit of both. So there've been some commentaries on, first, there's the initial shock that healthcare workers would be hesitant about vaccines. The expectation is that they will line up for it. One, because they're scientifically literate and they're supposed to know that vaccines are a good thing. And second, they're also at very high risk, just doing the work that they do during a pandemic. But healthcare workers also, you know, exist in the public world too. So while they might have more trust and more feelings of connection to the scientific institutions, they've also got the other things going on in their lives. The extent to that they've broken down vaccine hesitancy among healthcare workers regarding the COVID vaccines, they're finding the most hesitancy among long-term care workers. So these are often, they're called practical nurses. They're orderlies. They work in mainly old age homes, and they are the most at risk in many countries. They are also immigrant and racialized women who have been hugely disempowered and during the pandemic and not supported by the various institutions that should have been supporting them and keeping them safe. So they are harboring professional related trauma and distrust of the government and of public health at the same time that they're supposed to know that this vaccine is good for them. So I think there's a connection there between, their insider and their outsider status here.
Going back to this issue of trust, you say in your talk where you talk about this death of expertise thesis that trust is inherently risky, and that when you trust someone, you risk that trust you've placed in someone can be broken. That risk can never really be minimized. So trust involves this kind of leap of faith almost. But it's a leap of faith that most of us make based on some kind of evidence, right? And so you say, well, most of the public can't really assess, as we said, the technical expertise of scientific experts. I don't know if some pharmacologist is a good pharmacologist or not. And I can't tell whether a paper is good, even if it might be published. It might not be very respected by the community. And you say that one of the criterion that people sometimes use is assessing, say, the moral standing or the moral character of scientists and or of spokespersons, say, for scientific institutions. Is this person honest, conscientious, etc.? So is this criterion justified? I can hear the objection being, well, is there any connection between someone being a good scientist and being a good person? It might be human nature to revert to that standard that we have some expertise over, but is that a good way of going about it?
I think it's a good way, because we don't just want to have the person with the wonderful credentials. We also have to believe that they are reporting honestly and that they are giving us information that is actually in our interest. Mm. So there's quite a bit of research into who do people trust and why. And people will often prefer the person who they think has their interests at heart more than the person who's got the PhD or something like that. In fact, the more sophisticated expert with the more credentials might be more able to trick us because they've got the language and the ability to do that. So everything we know about public outreach around scientific issues, they always talk about, of course, get people who know what they're talking about, let's say to inform the public about vaccines. But we also look at secondary characteristics, like they need to be perceived as trustworthy. People are more likely to take vaccine information from a person who's a member of their community. That could be racial, ethnic, you know, women are more likely to listen to other women for information. So it means that they're using all kinds of cues to see that they're getting what is hopefully the best information. And the epistemic credentials aren't enough. You need the moral credentials too.
One of the more sort of perhaps more radical ways that you think of how scientific institutions and the scientific community can regain some of the trust that has been lost between them and the public is to include the public a lot more in their internal procedures, to make sure some concerns are addressed rather than dismissed as ignorant, a kind of almost democratization of science, if you like, rather than making it only the business of the knowledge elites. What do we make of the objection that, well, it's precisely the elite aspect of science, the high entry requirements, if you like, into the field and into that discussion that make it a success, and that democratizing it might actually water that down?
The people that have really thought about democratizing science, they suggest it as a good way to expand the legitimacy of science. One is so that the public stakeholders will be more accepting of it. And second, because the public can actually provide insight that can be useful. Okay, the public cannot provide all information that can be useful. Sometimes public information is not useful at all. But there are, you might know the famous case study on the Cumbrian sheep farmers done by the sociologist Brian Wynne, who had this case of scientists really getting it wrong, trying to figure out about nuclear fallout in the Cumbrian highlands. And instead, the farmers had this experience-based expertise. They knew the land better. So they actually had insight, compelling, scientifically relevant insight that the scientists didn't have. Same is true around management of chronic diseases. People who have lived with chronic illness for a long time often have insight into the day-to-day stuff that doctors coming up with protocols don't have. So you have to bring in the public expertise for a legitimacy to get the sort of credibility that you need to get everyone involved, but also because they have important insight. It doesn't mean that every person's idea about vaccines are going to be warranted. Some of them are going to be silly and some of them are going to be totally uninformed. But insofar as the public does have something valuable to contribute to the broader shaping of scientific questions and even the analysis of data, they should be brought in. It's too important and too complex to think that scientists know it all. In fact, they often don't.
Is this democratization of the scientific process the same as what we call citizen science? And I guess the follow-up question is, how do we ensure that this kind of science is more trustworthy? Because perhaps there will be people, I already have some concerns in my head about, you know, am I really going to trust the results of research that non-experts have been involved in? So yeah, is this the same as citizen science to include people in it? And is it going to be more trustworthy than what we have now?
There have been many models proposed about how to involve the public. Citizen science is just one example of that. Mm-hmm. And as many models have been proposed, there have also been critiques of the sort that you say, that we don't want to elevate public opinions to the point that they can actually wrongly influence science. So there's some balancing act here where we do recognize that the public can have legitimate knowledge, especially the communities, the publics that are most impacted by a scientific decision. So this is certainly the case around like environmental policy. You know, ask the people that live near the nuclear waste site. You might learn things about the experience that the scientists are not aware of. So those are good examples. Mm. But it doesn't mean that the publics have expertise on the very technical stuff. Chances are they will have some insight into the framing of the questions. They might even have some insight into the analysis of the data and the policies that should follow from there. But it's a balancing act where you don't want to overstep the expertise that the public brings. And you also don't want to take that expert-driven view that the public have nothing to add.
I might need your help here because I forget what the name of this is. This is also discussed in the context of alternative models of democracy, where you bring in experts and you have a kind of selection, almost like a jury selection from the citizenship, and you kind of bring them all together and you kind of hope for this is seen as a better version or a better model for democracy.
Right. Science juries, scientific juries, I think.
Scientific juries.
About.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So is this is almost the opposite. This is almost like, rather than infusing expertise into democracy, infusing democracy into the expert community. Is this something that also is part of this kind of science?
Yeah.
Citizen science.
Again, these are the sort of levers that we have to work with. A lot of those models of scientific juries involves an end product already created. So here's the science, and then you bring it to the jurists, the citizen jurists, who get to decide how do we apply it, that kind of thing. And some of the suggestions have been that you could bring the citizen involvement in a little earlier, even in the framing of the scientific question, and at points along the way in the research. If there is special insight that the scientists don't have that they should have, they don't know to ask for it. So they might be surprised by the analysis that the publics can offer. And again, all the while, the more you involve the publics, the more trust you're gaining, because the public want to be heard. They don't want to feel that scientists swoop into their communities and make decisions without proper regard and proper hearing of their voices and personal concerns.
I want to ask a question about the politics at the background of all this, the anti-vaxxer kind of community, and vaccine hesitancy has been used or exploited in the past by politicians. We've seen that even in the US with remarks that Donald Trump has made. We've seen it in Italy with Salvini and his party, the Northern League. You say somewhere in your talk that technical scientific disagreements are often disguised moral and political disagreements. And the question is, I guess, isn't this one of the reasons that people are sometimes anti-science? So not so much because their concerns aren't heard, or they're not feeling like they're part of the process, and you know, so that democratizing that would resolve that issue, but simply because they don't like the results, right? There are inconvenient truths, to use Al Gore's term, that science sometimes reveals, and it does mean that it might make our lives a lot harder or change some of the habits that we like, and the result is that some people develop this kind of anti-science attitude. And I think this is perhaps more the case in climate change than in vaccine hesitancy. So I just wondered what your thoughts are on this.
I think it's still the case that any anti-science attitude is because of the downstream effects of the science. So there's, I'll refer you to Roger Pielke's research into what he calls the linear model from science to policy, where he regrets that science gets used for political ends. So one reason that climate bloggers, both pro and con, so let's say public people who are invested in the climate debates, they'll, if you go onto the blogs, you'll sometimes see a very detailed analysis of what seem like very small technical problems, like different atmospheric measurements. One shows that we're warming at a fast rate, one shows lower, and they get into very technical debates about the models. And it seems that the reason that this is done is because they think that any kind of scientific finding that gets accepted as true is going to be tied to a direct policy. Right. So Pielke was writing sort of in the early 2000s, where he said the reason that people are so invested in denouncing climate science is because they think that if it is accepted as true, well, then Kyoto will be enacted. Mm. And there wasn't the political space to talk about whether Kyoto was the right policy to deal with this problem called global warming. Mm. So you had, because we live in this kind of scientized political atmosphere where everyone says, I follow the science, I follow the science. Yeah. You have to, right? Isn't that the COVID experience?
Totally.
Is you have to denounce the science rather than have the what might be legitimate political discussions about other policy alternatives.
Mm.
So Pilke regrets that we have to make it a fight about science instead of a legitimate political discussion about policy. And he also says we put so much energy into that we don't allow for, let's say, discussion of different policies. Like there's room for that. Mm. We could actually see what our priorities are and say, okay, if we accept that, you know, global warming is happening at this rate, what are five policy options instead of Kyoto or nothing?
Right.
So it actually limited what science can do to enable good policies.
That's interesting. Yes, I definitely think that this we're following the science motto is deeply problematic, because obviously politics is not guided by facts. It's also guided by values. And sometimes, you know, we need to be more explicit about that. And maybe it is in the interest of politicians to hide behind science and not have the values or political justice discussion with the electorate. Nonetheless, I mean, sometimes it will be the case that, you know, science just, the evidence for something is just overwhelming that, you know, there will be unpleasant consequences down the road. And,
right.
You know, we will have to deal with that in some way rather than just challenge the facts.
Right. Yeah, but those still strike me as value debates that should be happening. I mean, you know, we might agree that the climate is warming at a certain rate, but what we do about it, what we owe to future generations, those kind of questions, those are not going to be settled by the science.
So the last question is there one book that you recommend to listeners on the topic of epistemic trust, vaccine hesitancy?
Oh, there were so many good papers and so many good books. It's hard for me to.
Previous speakers have cheated and given me two books, so I can extend the courtesy.
Okay, I think the classic papers by John Hardwick on epistemic dependence and trust in science are very, very important and worth reading. I also really enjoyed a book that is actually on the question of reasonable doubt in science. So like manufactured consent and things like that. It's a book called The Fight Against Doubt by Immaculata de Mello Martin and Kristen Intamin, where it's called The Fight Against Doubt, and it's talking about how do we deal with sort of spurious doubt raised in science. And they actually, they end on a conclusion that we will never be able to sort legitimate dissent from illegitimate dissent, but that building trustworthy communities is the solution to that. And they actually land very much where I did on the question of trust. And I think it's worth reading, especially around the question of manufactured doubt. I think it's an interesting read.
And what about your book? Your book is coming out in the spring.
Oh, I hope you'll read that one. So it's coming out. It's already ready for it's available for pre-order already. It's released on March 9th, 2021. And it's called Vaccine Hesitancy, Public Trust, Expertise, and the War on Science, where I detail the two competing frameworks, the war on science for thinking about vaccine hesitancy versus the crisis of trust. And many of the issues that we talked about today are covered in the book.
Maya Goldenberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you'd like to listen to future episodes of The Philosopher in the News, subscribe and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, please spread the word and leave us a review. I confess that I myself very rarely leave podcast reviews, thinking they won't make a difference. But as a new podcast, we would really appreciate your feedback and support. Next week, I'll be talking to one of America's leading political philosophers, Elizabeth Anderson, about why relearning to talk to our political opponents is important for our democracy, and how to do it in an era of polarization and populism. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. Speak again next week.